Love Sport Radio. On digital radio, online, mobile, and smart speaker. This is Upfront on Love Sport.
You're listening to Upfront with James Gray, the podcast edition. You can listen to me live every weekday from 1 p.m. on Love Sport Radio.
This is Love Sport.
This is Upfront with me, James Gray, on Love Sport Radio. I'm here until 3:30 p.m. making jokes that make my producer Mike, who is the stand-in, remember? He's not my real producer, yeah? Will the real producer please stand up? Please stand up. But let's talk a little bit more football. Let's talk about Chelsea. They, of course, were in action last night in a thrilling game against Eintracht Frankfurt, a team who have surprised a lot of people in Germany this year, but they're flying. Remember, they were in the second tier only 6 or 7 years ago, so it's great to see that they are now doing well in the Europa League and a brilliant stadium as well. Let's run around my Chelsea player ratings, shall we? See who fared well, who fared badly, who Maurizio Sarri can be proud of. I start with the goalkeeper, although frankly that's about as much as he did. He couldn't do much about Luka Jovic's goal, a header sort of nodded past from range, but he was right in the corner. Riza Balago couldn't realistically have done much. It would have been a brilliant save. He had a quiet night otherwise, although no one really had a quiet night because it's pretty loud, so I've given him a 6. Cesar Azpilicueta, 5. Maurizio Sarri hinted that the Spaniard might have to fill in at centre-half because of injuries. That never came to pass, but he might wish he had, because instead he was given quite the tough night by left wing-back Filip Kostic, who certainly in the first half played very well indeed, and Eintracht Frankfurt might have had more than just one. David Luiz, also a 5 for me. He had a late-headed chance, which couldn't, maybe should have beaten Kevin Trapp, actually. But really, he was skinned far too often. He was out of position. He just looked like a mess of a defender. I really don't consider that he is a particularly good defender. I know he produces good passes, although we didn't see much of them on the night. And he did hit the crossbar with a free kick. But that's not what you need your centre-half to do. You need your centre-half to defend. I didn't feel he did that very well. Marginally better next year was Andreas Christensen, 6. Did seem to stem the flow a little bit after half-time. But he did pick up a horrible yellow card just 20 minutes in. Really poor tackle. Eventually seemed to settle into the game. But I thought he was a little bit intimidated by the whole occasion. Emerson Palmieri at left back, a bit of an attacking threat in the second half, but frankly not much of a final ball. I've given him a 6 as well. Overall, I didn't think Chelsea's defence did particularly well in the face of, certainly before half-time, first 25 minutes, a really rampant Eintracht Frankfurt team who probably think they should have been more than 1-0 up. Let's move into the midfield where I thought Chelsea were really strong. It was where they, well, they didn't win the game, but I thought that was where they triumphed on the night. N'Golo Kante continues to grow into that more advanced role. Some really crucial turnovers high up the pitch. His passing range is good as well. I've given him a 7. He almost pushed to an 8 for me. Jorginho too. He was an 8 for me because I thought slowly people are starting to come round to the idea that he's a very technically talented midfielder. Not only is he good at what he does, he creates space for other people. Now, Ruben Loftus-Cheek, who I've given a 9 and my Chelsea man of the match, he was able to flourish because of the space created by Jorginho. Because everyone knows that Chelsea's system goes through Jorginho, they close him down. And that creates space for the other midfielders to exploit. And Jorginho is good enough to half turn and to pass out of that pressure. So we're getting there with Chelsea, I think. Loftus-Cheek, as I said, my man of the match, 9 for him. Really brilliant in midfield, used his body well to protect possession. Just thought he was outstanding. Really showed us what he can do on his night. He was subbed off, by the way, 7 minutes from time. Mateo Kovacic in the now traditional change. Not very popular with the Chelsea supporters, but remember, Loftus-Cheek has not played 90 minutes very often this season because he's not fully fit. Still battling this persistent back injury, and we can't risk him in certain situations. The front three, Pedro, the pick of them. He obviously got the goal. It was a really nice finish. He always had a habit of scoring important goals at Barcelona, Champions League finals, cup finals. And he did it again. A really fine finish, actually. I've given him an 8. I thought he was a threat and could have had more than one goal. He moved very well, beat defenders almost at will, and played in off Olivier Giroud, who played like a classic centre-forward, really, backing in, making life difficult. He probably should have had a penalty given against him for a really obvious handball in the box. So obvious, actually, that Giroud put his hand on his head as if to say, oh no, what have I done? And the referee just carried on. He almost shopped himself there, but I've given him a 7 nevertheless, as I thought he did the job well. And finally, Willian. Look, I think he's been a lovely player for Chelsea. On his day, in his era, he was really good to watch. You know, an exciting player with the ball, works hard. Great free kick on him as well. I think that time has gone. I think it's time for Chelsea to move on from Willian. I gave him a 6 because he was pretty limited in his impact, as was his replacement, Eden Hazard, coming on after just, well, about half an hour to go on the hour mark. Hazard wasn't happy to be on the bench, and he frankly didn't look happy to be off the bench, because other than a free kick, which, as I say, David Luiz probably should have put away, I don't think there was a huge amount to recommend Eden Hazard's performance off the bench last night. He's a great player, and I think he needs a bit of time to get into a game. So I don't quite know why. I just don't see him as the kind of player who relishes coming off the bench. I think he enjoys the full 90 minutes of working out a defender, working them over, and tiring them out. I just think that's what he prefers. I've given him a 6, and I don't think he deserves much more than that.
Love Sport.
And we're still looking back, of course, at those games for the English clubs in the Europa League last night. Chelsea got a relatively creditable draw at Eintracht Frankfurt, 1-1, crucially that away goal. Arsenal, meanwhile, did win, 3-1 victors in the end, but they had to come from behind. They did concede an away goal, which may yet come back to bite them. Let's see what former Arsenal striker Kevin Campbell made of all this. Kevin, those nights can be tricky, and presumably, if you're Valencia, you've got that away goal, you must think you're taking something back home.
Yes, you do, especially when you score first. And, you know, you had really an open goal. To you could have made it 2-0. Arsenal started very shaky in the first 20 minutes. But then Arsenal, you know, got themselves back in the game and started to look like, you know, their front two started to gel together. Fantastic first goal, Aubameyang. You know, look really sharp last night. And Lacazette, who's probably been the player of the season so far for Arsenal, got them back into the game, got their noses in front. And I think that Aubameyang goal right at the death really is a body blow to Valencia, because I think they would fancy their chances if they went back to Spain just with the one goal deficit.
What do you put that bad start down to? Because I thought the first, you know, maybe 20 minutes, Arsenal looked a little bit like they do when they play away from home at the moment. There was some really harebrained moments. Ainsley Maitland-Niles header back to the goalkeeper, a few other bits and pieces. What do you put that bad start down to? Is there something going on in the dressing room, do you think? Are they just not getting up for the games enough?
No, I think they're up for it. I just think it was a bit of nerves.
Really?
I'll be honest with
you. As simple as that?
Yeah, I think it was a bit of nerves, and then you go a goal down, and then you need a foothold in the game. As soon as they got a foothold in the game, they settled down and they played some really good football. And obviously, you know, scored 3 goals in the end. But that the start is what's baffling everybody. You know, away from home, they don't seem to be able to get it right because of the mentality. So that, you know, there was a little bit of a carryover in the first 20 minutes, which, fair play to the players, you know, they got themselves back into the game.
So how do you deal with that? If you're Unai Emery, let's say Unai Emery rings up Kevin Campbell and goes, "Hey, Kevin," and if you can understand what he's saying, maybe you can tell him, what would you change about that team to try and counter those nerves and that little bit of lack of confidence that Arsenal seem to have?
I'm not Unai Emery, but what I was always was told was, you know, you set your stall out from in the first 15-20 minutes. What we're going to do, we're going to press. We're going to press the opposition at every opportunity. And that then puts you on a front foot mentality. In your mind, I know what I've got to do. But sometimes when the team starts, they look a bit too lackadaisical for my liking. And I think the message that they get, especially away from home, doesn't quite resonate with the players. I think they're in between. I don't think you could afford to be caught in between right now, especially at this stage of the season.
Are Arsenal glad to have this Europa League campaign alongside the Premier League campaign in the running?
I think so. I think Arsenal have been having to try and play two competitions at once, in a sense, because one competition in the Europa League, you've got to play your strongest team, because that's a chance to make it in the Champions League for the winners. And then in the league, because the games were coming thick and fast, he had to try and juggle his squad and still try and make the top 4. But I think now the top four really is out of Arsenal's hands. So I think the Europa League is really the one competition where you could say, right, if we win our games in that, you know, we're in the Champions League.
I saw an old teammate of yours talking this morning, Lee Dixon, saying that fans are disconnected from the team because they need to see progress on the pitch after, you know, what was a sad end to Arsene Wenger's reign. Do you think that Arsenal have made progress since Wenger left?
I do. I do think they've made some progress, but I still think there's parts of that team, and especially defensively, that need to improve. I think that would give the fan base a lot more confidence moving forward if they could get that defence right. Obviously, you know, the Unai Emery, I think having more points in the league and in the semi-final, well, really 1 foot in the final, if they defend properly away from home, you know, you look at it and you say, yeah, he has improved some parts of Arsenal, but there are still deficiencies that, you know, you won't get over the line, you won't even be able to challenge in the Premier League if you don't address them.
You mentioned earlier that Lacazette and Aubameyang up front, the chemistry that they're starting to develop. It's great to see a strike partnership again. I can't remember the last time we had, you know, a top side in the Premier League with a strike partnership. Tell me, in your experience, what makes a good partnership? Is it just time? Do you just have to spend time playing each other to understand how the other moves?
Well, it's funny sometimes. It depends who you play with. Sometimes you just click and you just know your teammate's game. And other times it has to be worked on the training ground to understand what your best traits are and what your strike partner's best traits are. And you know you really have to work at it.
Did you ever have a player in your career who you just, first training session, you went out and you thought, you know, someone like maybe Pierre Van Hooijdonk, who you played so well with, did you just go out and say, that's it, it works?
Well, I was very fortunate. It worked with Pierre Van Hooijdonk, it worked with Francis Jeffers, it worked with Thomas Radzinski at Everton. Those types of players, it just clicked for me. And you know, it wasn't a matter of you needed to actually work on it on the training ground. You complement each other. I think that's what all managers should be looking at if they're going to play a front two. You know, like, I think the last great partnership was Dwight York and Andy Cole.
Yeah, yeah.
At Manchester United, I think, as a strike pair. But I just think if we can get those boys chances, they will score goals.
Absolutely.
But, you know, we created some chances from yesterday, and Lacazette could have probably gone on with four goals.
Yeah, and then the rest.
You know, it's crazy.
Speaking of people who are among the goals, I have to ask you about Tyrese. Your son is, of course, on loan at Shrewsbury Town. 2 in his last 4. How exciting is it, you know, as a former player like yourself, to see him go out and do what you do, or used to do, I should say?
Yeah, it's very humbling as a dad, a football dad now, like so many others. Going and, you know, being in the away section and, you know, travelling to watch him play, I think it's fantastic. Makes us really proud, makes the family proud, and he's scoring goals and developing nicely, and it's been a really good loan for him at Shrewsbury Town.
Do you tell him much? Do you go, oh, you know, I would have brought that down and done this with it or that with it, or does he just get on with it?
No, I leave him to get on with it. I don't want to muddle his brain. But what I do is, you know, if he ever needs advice, he could ask me if he so wishes.
Yeah.
But he seems to be doing pretty well at the moment.
Yeah, if I know anything about young boys, Kevin, they don't bother really asking their old man for advice. They just
get
on with it.
That's right.
Thanks so much for coming on, Kevin. A real pleasure, as always, to speak to you. That's Kevin Campbell there, former Arsenal and Everton striker, and also the father of Tyrese Campbell, who's 19. He's on loan at Shrewsbury Town. He's got 5-12 already in the league there, and I think might have a rather bright future.
Love Sports.
To talk a bit more cricket is Love Sports' very own Guy Watts, who's in the studio. We've talked a lot about England's squad, about the ethos, about the team environment. It's nice to have a bit of cricket to talk about itself, but that doesn't mean there aren't stories off the field still floating around.
Afternoon, James. You're quite right. Just to stay with the actual cricket, I completely agree. Great to see the international summer finally underway. It had all the makings of a complete washout, didn't it, first thing this morning?
Yeah.
Early May in Ireland. Of course, it was delayed by rain. I think a little unfair to say that Jofra Archer won't be used to these conditions. He has, of course, been playing in Sussex, or for Sussex, in Hove for the last few years. And having spent a fair bit of time down there in my life, my dad lives down there. I've even been to Hove, or tried to go to Hove, to watch some cricket a few times. Not always successfully. I don't think he'll be a stranger danger to a little bit of rain.
All right, okay, I'll take your word for it. But he has played a lot of franchise cricket around the world.
He has,
which
in
is sun
places.
Following. Yeah, exactly. True. But he's I liked that his first ball in international cricket was an all right length ball, and Paul Sterling, a bloke with a first class average of about 25, just whacked him through the covers for four.
It was a really good shot. It wasn't a bad ball.
No, it was on a length, and he didn't even middle it. Brilliant. But we're talking about something a little bit more serious today, because a story that I sort of caught my eye from George Dobell of ESPN Cricket Info about Joe Clark and Tom Coler-Cadmore, two highly rated young batsmen, really, aren't they? They're guys who I think we've talked about both of them, really, as potentially being on the verge of a breakthrough at international level. Not so at the moment, it seems.
No, they've essentially been told that they won't be considered for England selection until further notice. So this is part of the continuing fallout from the Alex Hepburn case, which rather made the Alex Hales incident, if you like, pale into insignificance. Of course, Alex Hepburn, the Worcestershire cricketer, jailed for 5 years after being found guilty of rape last week, an extremely serious matter. And Clark and Coler-Cadmore were both involved loosely in the incident and the court case. It was specified that Clark had done nothing wrong on the night of the attack by the judge when he summed up his verdict, but that doesn't mean that in the eyes of the cricket authorities they were as blameless. They were both part of the WhatsApp group that Alex Hepburn was also part of, where they were saying some pretty nasty things, some pretty misogynistic things, and the aim was essentially to find out who could sleep with the most women in a certain period of time. And there was language in there as well that I think was particularly unsavoury, and it's certainly the sort of thing in this day and age where the repute of any game, any sport, is of serious importance, and if you bring it into disrepute, you are going to suffer some consequences, and that's what's happening to Joe Clark and Tom Coler-Cadmore at the moment.
Yeah, and it's not as though they didn't get, I suppose, rebuked in court. The judge called the WhatsApp group a, quote, pathetic, sexist game to collect as many sexual encounters as possible. Now, look, we're not implying that Joe Clark or Tom Coler-Cadmore, and that is important to say, had any involvement with the crime I'm at hand, but it is bad that they've been dragged into this trial. They were named, they were mentioned, and as I say, the judge pointed out that they had done things that they should consider about whether they should be doing them again.
Well, quite. They weren't there to be criminally sentenced, but rebuked, I think, is a good word to use. The ECB apparently concerned by the content and tone of the messages, which is a very bland way, I suppose, of saying they were extremely unimpressed by what they saw from a couple of guys who were hoping to represent their country in the near future in cricket. And it's, I mean, a good wake-up call, you might say, if you're trying to look at it in a positive light. I think I'm pleased to hear the news that they're unavailable for selection. The point is, it's pending the Cricket Discipline Committee's commission's decision of whether or not to do their own investigation and give out
busy
their own
lads punishment. The CDC, aren't they?
Yeah, so I hadn't heard of them really ever until the whole Bristol incident, when they became an extremely important and relevant part of the whole process. Even when Stokes was cleared criminally, he was subject to the CDC's own investigation. He and Alex Hales were both given punishments. They were largely suspended bans that they'd already served the actual parts of, and fines, but it was extremely important what they decided. And now again, it seems that they're going to determine exactly when or if Joe Clark and Tom Coler-Cadmore are eligible to play for England.
Do you think this sort of means that the ECB will now be checking everyone's WhatsApp messages and making sure they're not in all sorts of unsavoury groups?
I don't think it should be. Do you? Is that what you think should happen?
Well, I'm not saying either way, but it's certainly something that's been pointed out to me on social media multiple times, that isn't it double standards to say, well, we've found these WhatsApp messages and we don't like them. Shouldn't you then be making sure that everyone else is conducting themselves rightly?
I see the logic in that, but I think that way lies a very dangerous precedent. I think that these are all adults we're talking about, professional cricketers. I think that you've earned the right to not have your very private affairs, as these are, examined to that degree, unless there is considered a good reason, a seriously good reason, to have it looked into.
I.e. a criminal investigation, is in this case.
I wouldn't have been arguing for them not to have the messages looked at as part of the criminal investigation with regards to Alex Hepburn, but I think it's a little bit dangerous to start investigating every single element of a player or any individual's personal life, because I think that, you know, I know we hold sports people and people in the public eye to slightly different levels of account as we do to ourselves and the people that we know in ordinary life, but I think that nearly everybody could be incriminated by something taken certainly out of perspective or you know, in the wrong way from something what you said or done, especially over text or on social media. And I'm not saying that you should never be punished as a result of that, but I think it would be a dangerous precedent to set to say that every single player who wants to be selected by England has to have a full vetting of their text history.
Love Sport.
I want to look back a little bit though, because last night, a lot of football, and there's a few things that I think you might have missed. Arsene, what was your favourite bit of the game last night?
I didn't see it.
But you must have seen some funny moments in the game.
I didn't see it.
All right, what about that new Zac Efron film?
I didn't see it.
Well, at least I was watching, Arsene. I certainly was, and through the magic of television, I was watching both games. So there were bits and pieces all over the shop that you might have missed from the game. Certainly Arsene Wenger did, because he's got selective blindness. English teams have often been accused of not taking the Europa League seriously enough. That's clearly not true elsewhere, as Arsenal found out when they went to Rennes, and as Chelsea found out last night when Eintracht Frankfurt produced one of the loudest stadiums I've heard all season. In fact, it was so loud that even the broadcasters couldn't manage it. The BBC reporter at the game spent most of it complaining about the cigar smoke of the man sat next to him. In the press box, one of the Spanish radio commentators had just loaded up the biggest cigar you've ever seen. In the BT commentary box, things went even more wrong. They were out for 11 minutes. I think they just didn't come back from half-time. I think they were just, you know, Nigel Spatton was just like, don't fancy it. Think I'll just have another cup of tea. So they had 11 minutes of the second half with no commentary. In an effort to sort of deal with this, they had Owen Hargreaves and Glenn Hoddle sort of commentating from the studio on BT Sport 3. I don't fancy that Hoddle chap. I don't think he'll go too far.
I didn't see it.
For all the brilliant atmosphere in Germany at the Commerzbank Arena, and it was brilliant, by the way, I don't think Chelsea's backroom staff will have appreciated the facilities. They were sat on those stackable chairs, you know, like the ones that you used to put out in the sports hall for a special assembly. You know, if some Olympic medal winner from the 1970s turned up to give a talk, you put 300 of them in the sports hall and made lots of teenagers fidget in them for half an hour. That's what the Chelsea bench was sat on last night. I don't think they were very appreciative. At least they were using the seats, though, because one of the Frankfurt stands usually is exactly that, a stand. Of course, in Germany, standing in football matches is allowed, and they have safe standing installed. But UEFA games require stadiums to be all-seater, because UEFA are, you know, backwards and don't like making progress anytime soon. So the Frankfurt fans took matters into their own hands, and they started ripping up seats in their own stadium. I've seen fans rip up seats in opposition and rival stadiums. I've never seen them do it in their own stadium. Quite remarkable. But they were responsible about it. They were handing the broken seats to stewards to dispose of safely.
I didn't see it.
Do we consider Arsenal an environmentally responsible team? Really? I don't know. They're not green. They don't play in green. So I don't know if we really could consider them. They're certainly not like Forest Green Rovers, who are the most environmentally responsible. Forest Green Vegans, as I call them. But Arsenal were anything but that last night, even though they did recycle the ball a lot. Eh? Eh? Brilliant. I've just got a raised eyebrow from producer on that one. Last night, though, Arsenal may have missed the memo on this sort of UK-wide effort to reduce plastics. Because they handed out, in a world where you now have to pay 5p for a plastic bag, where the plastic bag has basically gone out of fashion, out of use, out of Africa, Arsenal handed out 60,000 of them at the Emirates last night. If you bought a ticket, and heaven forbid you buy a ticket to go to Arsenal because it costs you about £300, if you bought a ticket for Arsenal last night, you got a seat and a free plastic bag, which you were to hold up at the beginning of the game to create a sort of mosaic. It wasn't a bad mosaic, sort of red and white stripes, quite nice. I don't think a single Arsenal fan took them home with them. They said on them, please use over and over and over again. I mean, honestly, I know for a fact that plenty of Arsenal fans left them right there. If that's not wastage, I don't know what is. I don't know anyone who took them home.
I didn't see it.
They're the things that you might not have seen last night. The things that Arsene Wenger didn't see last night. And if he was watching Chelsea, he would have seen progress. And I think this is something that Chelsea fans have been very resistant to accept and starting to have to do so. Chelsea are making progress under Maurizio Sarri. There's no doubt about that. And if you're a Chelsea fan, you've spent the best part of 6 months telling us that Sarri's a problem. Sarri ball's a problem. But what you saw last night, after a great start from Eintracht Frankfurt, what you saw was what Sarri ball can do to teams who try and get hold of you, which is that Jorginho, at the base of midfield, plays really well under pressure and is able to cope with the fact that they're pressing him. Teams know that everything at Chelsea goes through Jorginho. So what they do is they flood to him. They absolutely flood to him. Now, if you then say, all right, well, that's going to create space elsewhere, you need a player who's good enough to get the ball out of his feet. And Jorginho is exactly that. Gets the ball out of his feet on the turn. And what did you see last night? You saw Ruben Loftus-Cheek thrive in the space created by Sarri ball. He was brilliant last night. And while I accept that's partly down to him, it's also down to the system. What you also saw is N'Golo Kante thrive through Sarri ball. He's playing further forward. He recovers the ball further up the pitch. And his passing range is greater. Maurizio Sarri is making Chelsea work, and for once, he's been given the time to do so.
Love Sport.
A cricket reporter must have all sorts of things in his or her bag. You know, a laptop, a dictaphone, a spare dictaphone, spare batteries. And in April and May, it's always important to have a woolly hat and maybe a waterproof as well. And I'm sure Rory Dollar, Press Association cricket correspondent, has exactly that. Are you quite warm over in Dublin, Rory?
Well, I was hand luggage only on my flight over here, but I did manage to get the scarf and the woolly hat in there, so I'm making good use of them today in Malahide.
Yeah, I bet. It's quite a change from your trip to the West Indies over the winter, I'm sure.
That's right.
I don't imagine England are enjoying themselves much in the cold either, but they certainly seem to be making some inroads into the Irish batting order. 95 for four, and I think having watched it on TV, and you may disagree, I would suggest that Ireland have thrown it away a little bit after a good start.
Yeah, it was a decent start. You know, in these games, sometimes Ireland have been guilty of losing a couple of wickets early and then having to sort of fight back. And Stirling and Porterfield really gave them a nice little foundation. But yeah, they made 55 without loss, and then they lost four wickets for 21 runs. So England are really the grip on here. And Ireland have a bit of work to do on the grid.
Much as the cricket should be the focus, and I'm glad the cricket has started, of course you will have spent most of the week not talking about cricket, rather talking about the intricacies of the contracts involved between the ECB and their players. How much do you think Alex Hales will go away now that the cricket has started?
Well, part of that is down to Alex Hales, really. He's due to bat for Nottinghamshire today. In their match against Durham. I think Alex Hales will only continue to be an issue insofar as the people who are batting in front of him for England don't make runs and he starts making runs, because there's a lot of issues around the side, as alluded to, but at the end of the day, England are building up to a World Cup, and if they're winning games, nobody will be too worried. If they're losing games and Alex Hales is scoring hundreds, the conversation changes.
Yeah, absolutely. I was a bit baffled, and I don't want to get stuck on Alex Hales, because his story's been around for a long time now, it feels that way. But the thing that baffles me is Ashley Giles talking and saying, look, if the story hadn't come out, he would still be in the World Cup squad. I don't understand that, Rory, because surely the betrayal of trust is him taking recreational drugs and getting this ban. So I don't understand how the ECB can sit there. Surely they could have sacked him and not said why, and they wouldn't have broken the confidentiality.
As I understand it, Ashley Giles was here in Malahide yesterday to speak to us and sort of try to fill in some of those blanks that you're referring to. And as far as I understand it, as the guidelines are, and the guidelines are being, they're imminently going to be reviewed, because I think the feeling is that the guidelines that are currently in place have proven unfit for purpose in this case. But as we understand it, as soon as this policy is activated, the chief medical officer, the ECB chief exec, and cricket, which is Ashley Giles, are the only people who are allowed to know. Mm. And as far as we're informed, the selectors, the captain, and the coach were not informed.
Right, and I suppose at that point it's very hard for everyone to make such a final decision, because not everyone is allowed to have all the facts at hand. That makes some sort of sense to me.
I think Ashley Giles pointed out yesterday that he's not a selector. He's in overall charge of cricket, but I think we'd be asking different questions if he managing director made a selection call and didn't tell the selectors why, that, then we're in a whole different ballpark. But as I say, it seems to me that this policy is going to be reviewed in association with the PCA.
Yeah.
And I think we'll see a little shift on this, because at the moment, we don't know how many people have got two strikes against. It's confidential. There could be, you know, it's unlikely, but there could be dozens of cricketers who've taken one and two positive tests that we simply don't know about. I think a review is imminent, really, in this.
Yeah, and well needed, I think. Let's come back to the cricket. There's obviously a debut for Jofra Archer, who couldn't have imagined more different circumstances when you consider most of his cricketing background, but nevertheless a debut. The inclusion of the likes of Joe Denyeau, David Malan, we understand, will open the batting with James Vince. Of those, I mean, Archer aside, we know his chances. How many of them do you think have a chance of breaking into maybe even the World Cup side?
Well, you can say for certainty that a batsman will come from outside of the 15, because Hales was in the provisional 15 that he named earlier this month.
Yeah.
So there's a batting place up for grabs. So really we're looking at James Vince and David Malan probably head-to-head. I mean, they're going to open the bat together today, and they're going to open together with the idea that probably only one of them is going to make it. So I'd be watching for those quick things.
Yeah, the old run out your partner in an effort to cement
place.
Yes, no,
maybe. Very clever.
Yes,
no, maybe today, perhaps.
Yeah, perhaps so. Rory, of course, we expect England to win this game, but they've got this series against Pakistan coming up. To what extent do you think that'll be experimental in terms of selection, and to what extent do you think they'll just put their best 11 out and say, let's win these games and get some momentum going?
Well, I don't think it'll be experimental, actually. I think if there are changes, it won't be because they're looking at new combinations. I think they're looking at it as the nature of this World Cup. It's a 10-game round robin. You know, you've got 10-12 games to win this World Cup. And the idea is, England don't believe they're going to do that with 11 players playing every single game, every, you know, 3 and 4 days turnaround each time. England have come to the conclusion that their 15-man squad, everyone's going to play a big game. They're not going to try and get the same 11 players through the entire tournament start. So it won't be experimental, but I think you'll see a few rotations, because England want all of their eventual squad members to come into that World Cup with a decent amount of cricket under the belt. So one T20 after this, and then 5 ODIs against Pakistan, and I reckon you'll see a different 11 almost every time. But the reasoning for that is they just want everyone to have a gallop under their belt before the tournament proper gets underway.
Rory, thank you so much for that update and insight, as always. Rory Dollard there, Press Association cricket correspondent, freezing his little hands off out in Dublin, no doubt, because Ireland are 103-4 after 21 overs at Malahide. Delayed start because of a wet outfield, 45 overs aside that game. And it's interesting talking about this Alex Hales stuff, and there will be a change in policy, because much as the confidentiality clause exists to protect players and to protect their welfare, it does create difficulties, as has been demonstrated, because if then that confidentiality is broken, all of a sudden you have to flip-flop. And I'm not saying the ECB have flip-flopped, but they've basically had no choice. They basically have only been able to do exactly what they've done, insofar as not even the selectors knew. You know, so Giles could have dropped Hales, but he's not a selector. So he would have had to go into the selection committee and say, lads, for a reason I can't tell you, we need to drop Alex Hales. And they'd go, well, what do you mean? Like, how can we make this decision? So essentially, it seems to me that this is a poorly negotiated agreement to keep these things confidential, and it's going to need changing. It's going to take time to change, because if there's anything I know about cricket and cricket's governing bodies, everything takes time to change. But we'll certainly see some changes. I hope that's the last we have to talk about it this summer, because there's so much cricket to be played. A World Cup at home, an Ashes at home, and England have a really good chance of winning both of them.
Love Sport.
This is Up Front with James Gray. On Love Sport, we're here until 3:30 p.m. And I want to talk a little bit of tennis as well, because there's been some good news from the tennis world, which has not always been the case in recent weeks. Justin Gimelstob, who was, until recently, on the ATP board of directors as a player representative, a former coach, a former player, and a Tennis Channel commentator as well, he has stepped down. Now, you may know that the reason he stepped down is that he assaulted Randall Kaplan, a former friend who was involved in a dispute, basically. He was friends with Gimelstorff's former wife. There was a dispute over custody. And for whatever reason, Gimelstorff decided to attack Randall Kaplan on Halloween night last year. He was with his wife, he was with his children, and he punched and kicked Kaplan 50 times, according to eyewitnesses. The witness statement during the trial was pretty harrowing, actually. Kaplan's wife, said she suffered a miscarriage because of the trauma a couple of weeks later of the attack. Doctors could find really no other reason other than the stress of that attack. Really, really brutal, actually. And Gimelstorff initially kept his place as ATP Board of Directors member. He had to be voted out by 5 of the 6 people. In the end, he fell on his own sword earlier this week. But the lack of players coming out... Remember, the players could have voted him out. The lack of players coming out against Gimelstorff and saying, actually, no, we don't want you as part of the senior part of our sport anymore. The number of players who failed to do that was staggering. And actually, I was speaking to tennis journalists who were doing the maths on whether they could get a six-man majority, because they needed 6 of the 10 player representatives, playing board of players council. They needed 6 of the 10 men to vote him out. And they did the maths and they didn't think they could get 6. They thought the majority of them would vote in favour of Gimelstorff when his contract was up for renewal later this month. Now, that to me was annoying. And you'll have heard me on this show before state that I thought it was a disgrace to tennis, actually. But the good thing is, not everyone thinks that way. Not everyone thought that they didn't want to speak out against Justin Gimelstorff. And you will have seen, I hope you will have seen, and if not, I can certainly relay to you the idea, the details behind an open letter written by Stan Wawrinka, the Swiss player, of course, who's had his battles with injuries and actually had a pretty tough year all round. But he wrote an open letter to the Times, basically saying that morals are declining in tennis. Now, that's a pretty punchy thing to say for a guy who is an influential and respected member of the tour. But to say that morals are declining suggests a lot about your fellow professionals. And he said that this past 6 months have been eventful. Sadly, politics have overshadowed the actions on the court. The episode has left many players, myself included, concerned about the direction tennis is heading in. He also mentions that tennis is an intrinsically selfish sport. And he's right, it's an individual sport. And you have to work very, very hard to get to the top of it. And you have to kind of be a bit selfish. You have to say, actually, you know what? Yeah, mum, dad, can you give me a lift here? Or, no, I'm going to train this. I'm going to give up on certain people or certain friendships or certain things. That's what you have to do. So I understand when you then come across some people who are a little bit hardy about certain things. You know, a little bit struggle to necessarily show the selflessness behind their actions. With Gimelstorff, it seemed really obvious to me. It seemed really obvious that we should come out and vote against him and make sure that even if we say one day you should be allowed to come back into tennis, at the moment, immediately after what the judge said was effectively a guilty plea because he pled no contest in the trial, even in the very aftermath of that, he's probably not an appropriate man to have making decisions at tennis. Imagine what message that sends out to the rest of the tour, to the fans, to the people watching tennis, about what they think of someone who, and Cathy Whittaker used this word, toxic masculinity has affected so badly. I don't know whether it's toxic masculinity that has affected Justin Gimelstorff, whether just sheer jealousy or frustration, anger. I don't know all the issues going on in his life. But I'm glad he stepped down from the board of directors because it's taken us out of a very uncomfortable position. But I'm disappointed that the majority of players have been cowardly enough not to speak out against him. That may be because he's too powerful. Maybe we've let someone get too powerful in tennis that no one is willing to speak out against him and say, you know what, Justin Gimelstorff has made a mistake and we should not allow him to be a senior and powerful man in tennis. Even before the verdict, he was pulling the strings of important decisions. He was part of the plot to remove Chris Kommode. He was instrumental in that. And while I do believe in innocent till proven guilty, surely they could have stood him down temporarily while this investigation was going on. Because it doesn't sit well that a man who was accused of what was quite a serious thing, and quite a violent thing as well, by the way, was still able to have massive, massive influence on the future of tennis. Whether you thought Chris Kermode should go or not is neither here nor there. He was a figure that clearly split the room with players, but did oversee a lot of progress in tennis, actually. But the point is not whether you agree or disagree with Chris Kermode. The point is that Justin Gimelstob was still able to make a massive difference in tennis, even while he was under investigation. That doesn't sit right with me whatsoever. I really think that Stan Wawrinka has made us all take a long, hard look at the sport and how it's run.
Love sport.
Big weekend for you, Ewan. I hear you're racing again. Big comeback.
I feel a bit lazy, though. I'm only doing a 10K. And half the guys, a couple of guys in the office, including Patrick, did the London Marathon at the weekend. So that's awesome. But
what were you out watching the marathon?
No, I wasn't this year. I watched it at home on television. But I'm going to run it next year. I've done 8. So I reckon I should do 10 before I hang up my marathon shoes.
Were you always going to do next year's? Or was it a case of watching it on the telly and going, I've got to do it again?
A bit of both, if I'm honest with you.
Yeah.
I mean, I was meant to do last year and I had to drop out because I hadn't done enough training.
Yeah.
It's one of those ones where the marathon does hurt. There's no two ways about it. You finish and you think, I'm never doing that again. But then actually, a few days later, you think, it's amazing. The characters you meet, the stories you hear about. So I'm definitely going to do it.
You know, I compare it, and it's not comparable in terms of levels of pain, but that emotional roller coaster, it's like childbirth. Because, you know, as you know, a new father, and congratulations again
Thank you.
It's impressive every time. But, you know, as a woman giving birth, you go through, obviously, a lot. And then 3 days later, you're like, oh, I might do that again, actually, because look at this. And it's almost comparable.
Trust me, you'd rather see the end of the marathon than what happens when the lady gives birth. That is a scene I don't want to see again. But the marathon, it's just like you said, it's all the emotions, isn't it? You go through a lot of pain when you're running. You get a lot of sense of pride when you finish. And then you get very emotional when you kind of remember why you've run, because the majority of people will be running for a fantastic charity or perhaps a loved one they've lost. There'll be a personal battle they'll be going on through that course of the marathon. So,
but then you're a slave for pain as well.
I quite like it. Yeah,
it's an athlete thing, isn't it?
And look, at the weekend I'm doing this 10K and I've already said to my mate, listen, a couple of K from the end, let's just really go for it so we're finishing in maximum pain. I quite like hurting myself. It sounds a bit weird, but...
Well, no, I think that's it's a thing that happens when you're an athlete. Because your body fires all the endorphins afterwards, it's like a drug, almost literally. You're wanting to push yourself hard enough so you get a bigger hit at the end of endorphins.
Definitely.
I can kind of understand it. Tell us what you've got coming up on Love Sport Drive this afternoon.
Well, we're going to talk about the Caster Semenya debate. You know, should she be able to compete? Or should she be given these suppressant drugs? Or will she actually retire now? She's hinted to the fact she will retire.
Mm.
She does race, I think, tomorrow night in Doha.
Yeah.
So they've obviously got faith in her and want her to be at that meeting. But I think she's pretty much had enough of it, because it's a tricky one. It's not her
You
fault.
Must know a lot of people who race against her and stuff.
Yeah, so if you look at their point of view, I totally see why they're not happy. They're up against someone who genetically has an advantage and they're going to struggle to beat her week in, week out. But then you see, Caster Semenya didn't choose to be born this way. She hasn't gone out and decided she wants to change gender. She wants a man, clearly has that advantage which she strives for. She was born this way, and it's really, I think it's quite sad, actually. The whole situation is quite sad. It's a no-win situation, because she feels she's been hard done by and she should be allowed to compete. It's not her fault how she was born and the genetics she was given. But then the rivals say, well, it's not a level playing field.
You obviously have a lot of friends who compete in athletics. What's been the general consensus between people that you know in athletics? Has it been split down the middle, or have people generally said, no, we should be supporting Caster here?
I think most people think it's really unfair, the whole situation for her, but she shouldn't be able to compete because she clearly has an advantage. There was a couple of seasons where she was in these suppressant drugs to reduce her hormone levels, and she was 3 or 4 seconds slower than what she was without them. So she clearly has got a natural advantage over the other girls. But it's just, I think it's going to open a can of worms now. And I think, you know, that there may well be other people in sport who would be proven to have this advantage. The sad thing is, I suppose, really, I mean, she's a fantastic athlete, but if she was competing against men, for example, she'd be a pretty bang average club standard runner.
Yeah, she'd be
running
156,
150, you know, it's not that good.
Mm.
So, but it, unfortunately for her, against the females, it's very good.
Yeah, exactly. She's not the world record holder, though. I do keep pointing this out. She's the fourth fastest woman of history over 800 metres. Maybe we should ask some questions of, I don't know.
Yeah,
maybe. That world record has stood since 1983, and maybe we should be having a little look at that.
This is Love Sport.
You've been listening to Upfront with James Gray, the podcast edition. You can listen to me live every weekday from 1 till 3 p.m. on Love Sport Radio. And don't forget to leave us a rating and a review on iTunes or wherever you get your podcasts.